Hi, everybody. We're back in the never-ending series on covariance and contravariance and now morphing into monads. I'd like to introduce my old friend. Well, you're not old. But
well,
long-time
the gray hair
friend,
seems yeah. to say, say I am.
Longtime friend, Greg Meredith. We've worked together for a long time. And in the course of doing this series with Eric on covariance and contravariance, I mentioned some aspects of it to Greg, and in particular, I mentioned my hunch that coordinatization has something to do with monads. Mm. And so let me just take a moment to recap this before handing things over to Greg, because Greg noticed something that I think is going to make the going to be of great interest to Channel 9 viewers, or at least those who like this series of stuff. The picture that I've drawn now several times has a P in the middle, and P is a set of positions on the globe, say cities like Perpignan and Belfast and Reykjavik. And I have here a set of coordinates. You'll just excuse the notation. I have to draw them like this because I need to distinguish the fact that these sets contain vectors.
Okay.
So this might be Latlon Alt.
Okay.
And this might be XYZ in some... Mm-hmm. astronomical coordinate frame.
Okay.
And given Belfast, I can go up here and say, what are its coordinates?
Okay.
And given Belfast, I can go over here and say, what are its coordinates in this system?
Right.
And I can draw, given any Latlon alt, right. under normal circumstances, singularities aside, I can get the XYZ and vice versa. Mm. And there are a couple of other little things on here that probably not germane today, but just anybody who's seen this picture before may miss these little guys here. This is time.
Okay.
And I'm flying from some place to some other place.
Okay. So,
and as a function of
Belfast
time.
Belfast to Reykjavik.
Yes, I can find a position.
If
the volcanoes are cooperating today. And given a position, I can find out how much fuel I've spent.
Right.
And covariance and contravariance, at least in the physics sense, has something to do with making a coordinate change from.
Right.
From. Latlon out to XYZ.
Right.
But what I want to ask you about is I had a hunch that going from here to here, in other words, assigning a coordinate to a point, it seemed like taking a value and putting it in a monad,
yeah.
such as taking a number and putting it in a list, or taking a variable and closing over it in a state monad, creating one of these state monad things, which is a function, it's a closure,
yeah.
from a state to a value in a state.
Yep.
I just got this hair going up on my neck that there's something similar there. And maybe it'll shed light on covariance and contravariance if my hunch is correct.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when you first told me about this, it really sparked a bunch of stuff for me.
Yeah,
because I've been thinking a lot from two different angles about the idea of nominal access in programs. So we kind of know what that means, right? It's you have variables.
Yes.
Right, and variables sort of denote locations in programs, and they also denote locations in data structures. So, for example, if you have a struct. We might reference some location in the struct by a name,
right.
or some label in the struct, and that is contrasted with positional access. So, like
yes.
if we have a data structure like a list or a tree, we have some positional way. Like I can talk about the nth element of a list,
right?
Right, and like when you and I worked on BizTalk together, right? One of the things that was really interesting was the underlying formalism that we used. Depended entirely on a sort of non-geometric notion of location, or it was
right.
just names.
Just
which,
a name. It
just
was
a sea of flat locations. There was
right.
no relationship amongst them.
Now, would that be like this sea of towns? Belfast and Perpignan and
well, that
and
was the question I always had.
Yeah.
Was that this thing or was that thing? Right.
Right.
Because they had no structure to them. It felt more like this.
Yeah.
And so I always wanted, but as soon as you started having programs or processes that coordinated using those locations,
right.
they started to feel like they had some kind of internal structure.
Right. Right. Right.
Right? And especially if you could pass things between programs. Right? So like if we want to write some kind of messaging substrate and I want to pass you a bunch of XML,
right?
Right? Then I want some relationship between the nominal stuff
Yeah.
And the positional stuff, because if I pass you some XML, you want to be able to access deep inside.
Yeah. But on the other hand, at some point, we have to agree on a URL or some way so that you can actually give me the XML.
Exactly. Exactly. And so what's the relationship between
all those? That URL doesn't have any structure that's of interest at all. It just gets me the blob of XML. But once I get the blob of XML, then I want to find positions or locations in that.
But we do know that the URLs do have structure, don't they?
From a different point of view, don't they?
We walk down the URLs, right? And, and that's actually quite an interesting...
So the URL isn't like X.
No, because evidently it's
not. The structure is
it actually has a tree structure.
Right.
Yeah.
Because if I want to talk to this part of your web service, I got to say one thing. I want to talk to this other part of your web service, I got to say something
I give a different path.
Yeah,
absolutely. So one of the things that I noted, and I think you noted the same thing, which is that when I put something in a container, so like I put an int inside a list, right, then I've now, in some sense, given it a position.
Yes.
This reminds me of, we were talking yesterday, and Michael Benedict, is an architect friend of mine, said one of the primary functions of buildings...
You mean a building architect?
Like a building. Yeah, not a software.
Bricks and mortar.
Bricks and mortar kind of guy. Yeah, real bricks and mortar kind of guy. He said that one of the primary functions of the built environment, of buildings in particular, is to address people and things.
Oh, very interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
And so that's...
The building itself has an address, but then I can say I'm in my office in the building.
Exactly.
I may have a different telephone there than I have in the kitchen or whatnot.
Exactly. And even with relatively...
And one of my kids has this bedroom and another kid has this other bedroom.
Right. And so, like, when you want to tell the UPS guy, deliver, this box of goods to that bin over there,
right,
in that room, in that building, on that street, right? All of that addressing stuff is a part of the built environment. It's a part of the
very
containers.
Very interesting.
Right?
If you remove the building, I just have a... flat blob of land.
Where do I put the stuff?
Where does the TV go?
If you had the XYZ coordinates, right, you could say, well,
that's
it kind of goes up there.
There's
no building there to support it, so that's an interesting use of skyhooks. But
so really, putting a string in a list at the third position is very much like giving it a coordinate.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And so that was sort of one of the things that I was following, and when you talk to me about this thing, that's what sparked.
But
me.
Now we can drag the generality back the other way, because monads are, you boil away all the particulars, and you're left with this very simple structure that allows you to go back and forth. You can transform from one monad to another. I can take a list and turn it into a state monad, or vice versa.
Right. Yes.
Or even more pertinently, into a tree.
Yes.
Take a tree and turn it into a list, vice versa. That looks a lot like coordinate transform.
Yeah, I know where you're heading. I know where you're heading. Because we rehearsed this last time.
Yes.
But
darn, now everybody's out of
this. No, but this really is free jazz. Because before we get there, I want to mention that even with an unordered structure like a set, which is also a monad,
right,
we can get a kind of addressing scheme, right? Because we have nested sets.
Ah.
Right?
Ah.
And you observe this, right?
Yes.
You can actually associate binary numbers
with a nesting level.
With the nesting level.
Right.
That's exactly right.
The primary bit that you get for any element of a set is whether it's in there or not.
Yes, exactly.
And then if there's nesting structure, you can continue to add bits until you get...
That number is a lot like a path, like a URL.
It's just like a path, yes.
Right? And paths are also useful. But I want to separate out this idea of an address from a location.
Okay, good. Let's clarify that.
Because, a long time back, hundreds of years ago, we had this very clever guy, Mr. Descartes, right, who gave us this wonderful tool, this analytic geometry.
Right.
Right?
He gave us these.
He gave us this. That's exactly right. But one thing that got conflated was addressing and location.
Right.
Now, interestingly, in the context of computing...
Now, before you go on, are they conflated entirely at this level, or are they conflated between these two levels?
I don't know.
Okay.
I honestly
don't
know.
See, it is free jazz.
Yeah.
And that's the most fun.
But along the way, and very recently, a Frenchman by the name of Huet, I can't pronounce French.
Huet.
Let me borrow one of those.
Huet.
Yeah, I'll write it over here. So this guy here, Huet, developed this notion of a zipper.
Ah.
Okay?
Yes.
And his thinking, he was really just trying to build what would be called an applicative structure editor.
Yes.
Okay, so by applicative, he just means functional. And what does he mean by that? Well, he wants to say, you know, I want to be able to navigate arbitrary structures, trees, lists, you know, sets, whatever.
And anybody with deep experience in functional programming knows that manipulating trees is deep water.
It's deep water because you might have to do a bunch of copying.
Yeah, it's horrible. Yeah.
Right? And so what he discovered was an intermediate data type, which he called the zipper, that allowed him to minimize the copying.
Very good.
So, but he actually got two benefits out of the zipper. One was that it was generic. Okay? And so it actually works over lots of different data structures.
Right.
And it gives you both navigation function and mutation.
Okay. Navigation means location.
Right, exactly.
You've got to be able to find it, but not the same as position.
Well, there's a correlation to position, right? And I think your idea of addressing, of separating addressing from location, right, and sort of concocting this intermediate notion of location is a good one, right? Because I don't think that Uwe was thinking about this stuff in terms of physics.
No.
He was trying to build... It's a little functional pearl. It came out in 1997.
Yes. I vaguely remember this.
Yeah.
Right? He would identify a place in a tree, and you could prove that any changes were below that location in the tree.
Yeah.
And so you didn't have to copy the stuff that was above it. I remember seeing these little triangle diagrams with the little dark part. Exactly.
So the other thing he gave us was this notion of location. And his trick was this. So if we imagine that we've got some tree, I don't know, and we want to talk about this location here.
Right.
Well, we sort of split it into a context, right, which is sort of everything that is not that.
Yeah.
And the subterm.
Right.
The subtree.
Right.
Right? And that's basically...
Now, this guy has an address consisting of left, right, left, 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 right, right,
or
which is isomorphic to a binary number.
That's right. So it's the path, which is a lot like the URL.
Right, right.
Right? So this the context plus the thing you plug into the context, the subterm, which is the rest of your tree.
So we know that this guy, we know what an address is in this guy. It's the path.
Mm-hmm.
We know what a location is. It's that node.
Right.
What's the position? What's the notion of position in this kind of example here?
Okay. So I think, again, the terminology that we were sort of marching towards was sort of location and address.
Okay. Right. Those are very clear.
Right. And so location is essentially that thing which is identified by the splitting.
Yeah.
Okay?
Right.
Right, so the splitting is context, which I'll call maybe C, right? And the little subtree, which I'll call T.
Right.
Right, and this is usually the way it's written, sort of if you go delving in the literature, of how to plug this tree into the context.
Right.
Okay?
And once again, the context is everything that isn't.
Everything that
it's
isn't.
It's a complement, in a sense. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So it's the context plus the tree. That gives us, so the splitting... The pair, context together with the tree.
Right.
That pair is our notion of location.
Yeah.
Right? And the address is in some sense, you know, the path down to there.
Right. Okay, this is very clear. This notation, by the way, looks like a bunch of other things that we know and love.
Yes.
Looks like Brian Kett in quantum mechanics.
Oh, yes.
It looks like Conway games.
Oh, man.
It looks like data can cuts.
Data can cuts, exactly right.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. I really like the thought that this is somehow related to Conway games or data can cuts, because that's exactly the way it feels. It's sort of what's behind us and what's in front of us.
But now the hair just went, what little hair there is, went up on the back of my neck. Because once you have Conway games or data can cuts, you have exact real numbers.
Yes.
And now you're back in the continuous realm where you can do calculus.
That's exactly right.
You can do derivatives and things like that.
I'm so glad you said that. Yeah. Because, in fact, after Uwe found this structure, a fellow by the name of Connor McBride It turns out there are two generalizations of this idea, right? And one of them is by McBride, and the other is by Oleg Kiselyov.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, Mr. Monster Haskell Coder.
Unbelievable. This guy is.
But actually, both of them are relevant in our discussion. But let's just talk about this guy. It turns out that Connor McBride discovered that you can calculate the context, the type of the context, from the type of the container.
Okay.
So if we have a notion of tree.
Right.
Okay. Then how do we get a tree context?
Okay.
And it turns out that the operations which calculate knocking a hole in a tree, which is essentially what a context is.
Yes.
Is follow the rules of differentiation. We have a kind of derivative.
Beautiful. Well, that makes total sense because in the continuous world, calculating a derivative is knocking a hole in a function, in a sense that if I have a function that I'm using my notation again. Let's say I have a function whose type is it will take an element of x and map it to an element of y. The derivative of this function automatically has the type x to x. Y. Mm, mm, mm. It knocks a hole. The derivative process knocks a hole, another hole in there. Now, the meaning of this is this could be some horrible nonlinear thing. This entire thing is a function that will give you a linear approximation to this thing.
Yes.
So if I tell you that I want the best linear approximation at Belfast to the surface of the Earth, then you can give me that. This guy is completely linear. It's a matrix.
Yep.
You just multiply matrices. This guy could be who knows what, sine of cosine of wildly oscillating mess. But this guy's guaranteed
sine of 1 over x.
At the cost of a at the cost of a hole.
Yeah.
At the cost of an extra hole, meaning tell me where you want the linear approximation.
Yes.
I can now, and that's the magic here. This guy can calculate a linear approximation anywhere.
The interesting thing about what you said, actually, what you said just sparked all kinds of connections for me. But one
so
of
I hit another. I just did a transition.
Yeah, yeah.
And now you get to riff on that one.
Hey,
perfect. Have a diminished chord.
Oh, I love diminished
chord. Public transportation, baby.
All right. Well, let me see if I can do a baseline walk under that.
All right.
So it turns out that there is a kind of linearity going on in this derivative. And what you're doing is you're finding linearity in the sense of no copying.
Okay.
Okay. So so you know how lambda terms can go all wonky and crazy because of nonlinearity. Like one of the weirdo ones is lambda x applied to x.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's nonlinear in the sense that x occurs twice.
Right.
Right? And that's the weirdness of lambda in general is that we get to use this resource willy-nilly.
Sure.
Right? And linearity is a discipline whereby you only get to use the resource
not
once,
allowed to do that. Yeah.
Right? And in fact, what happens is that the linearity that's going on here, which imposes a certain kind of discipline on where you can put the hole.
Right.
Right, is exactly the same as the linearity going on here. At least at the level of the algebraic structure that you calculate.
This
I'm so tempted to start whipping out the equations now.
Well, do. I mean, nobody's afraid of math here.
Oh, awesomeness.
Yeah.
Awesomeness. Well, the thing that was really intriguing to me before even calculating that derivative, though, is...
Try black or blue. It shows up on camera better.
Okay, fair enough. Let me go with the black. Let me go with the black. Is since we genericize this idea of location,
right?
Right, and in the context of discussing lambda, we can think of lambda as just another container.
Okay.
The term language is just another container, right? So remember at the outset of this, I said I'm really interested in relating nominal and positional information in programs.
Right, right,
right. Because secretly, what I want to do is I want to find geometry as a kind of P.
Ooh, ooh, ooh.
But as a kind of P that is a program.
Oh, I see. Now instead of doing reduction on lambda terms or term rewriting or pi calculus reductions, we're going to do geometric stuff.
Right.
We're going to take out our protractors and
well, that's your secret agenda. Actually, I wanted to go the other way.
No, I do too.
I want to do Wheeler's thing. It from bit.
Okay, good. I want to do discrete mathematics with matrix multiplication.
Well, then we're some people do go that way.
I say tomato, you say tomato. Yeah.
But check this out. I mean, even before we calculate our derivative, let me look at some of the promise of this idea.
Okay.
In terms of our original entree to this, right? So let's write down the data type for lambda, right? So I tend to write it like this. And I give two-headed rules. I've got more variables if I
need. Because actually, you're going to be very linear in your BNF. You can't use M twice, can you?
A lambda term, M or N, is either some variable mention.
Right.
Right? Or it's an abstraction.
Yes.
Or it's an application, M applied to N.
Yes.
Okay, so that's usually the way we might write this down. Now, the one thing that has always bothered me about this, right? Where does this X come from?
Yeah.
Right? If I fed this spec into, what's the Microsoft thing, M?
Yeah.
Right? M would complain.
Yeah.
M would say, what's this X thing?
I don't know what this is.
Right? Yeah. How are we doing time-wise? Are we good?
Yeah, we're good.
Okay, cool.
I think we're good.
All right. And
this comes outside of the entire description as if by magic.
Right, as if by magic. And then some people will supply string, some people will supply de Bruijn indices.
Yeah, and then you get into all the free variable versus all that mess.
All that mess, right? And so I tend to think of this, and I think most people now who are using Haskell or F-sharp or something like that will think of the data type as actually parametric in this thing.
Ah, okay.
Okay,
so
I'll now start to get slightly more formal.
Okay,
right. So this is really now it's parametric in X.
Right.
Right. Or and what it's maybe I'll start adding the polynomial structure. So it's X or functions from X into M of X.
Oh yes.
Right. Or it's pairs. Well, actually, let me still just treat these as pairs. We'll just stay syntactic, right? So it's X cross, and then this is, again, just pairs of MX, MX, like that.
Okay, we got two different kinds of X.
Yeah, let me put
a circle around of them, and we'll just remember that it means times.
Or I can just say V for variable.
Oh, even better.
So I'll change all that.
Good, good.
So we have V.
And a V times an M of V.
Yeah, and likewise here.
And an M of V times an M of V.
Yeah.
Now we have something that looks exactly like a polynomial.
Yes, that's exactly right. And these are the kinds of things you can differentiate.
It's a quadratic polynomial.
Yes.
Which is extremely interesting.
Yes, that's right. That's exactly right.
Because quadratic, I don't know. I'm not sure I know why it's interesting, but it is interesting.
Well, it's
not cubic.
No.
It's not linear.
No, it isn't.
It's quadratic on purpose for some very good reason.
This is precisely where the nonlinearity of lambda calculus arises.
Yes.
Is exactly here.
Right.
That's right. And in fact, if you were to write this is really a fixed point equation, right? Why is that? Well, because I have M over here.
Right.
And I have M here and here and here.
The solution to this fixed point equation then is the set of all lambda terms.
That's exactly right.
The set of all lambda terms.
The set of all lambda terms.
Right.
That's right.
Okay, good.
Right. And usually when we talk about that set, we'll mod it out by what? By alpha equivalence.
Yeah.
Right? Right. So
we don't care V.
Yeah,
W.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. So just like when we know if I write some function foo in a variable x, and if I consistently change everywhere that function to use y instead of x,
as long as you don't capture any free variables,
variables, then we really want those functions to be the same.
Yeah,
And no programmer worth their salt would really want those functions to be different.
In a profound way, though, that's an admission that the names come from outside the universe.
Yeah, yeah. Right. That
extra rule, that alpha equivalence, where you have to say something about those guys,
yeah,
is an admission.
That's exactly right.
I'm ashamed. They have to come from some strange place.
Yes, my name is Greg Meredith, and I've been using variables for exactly right. So it turns out that in order to really think about this equation in steps or stages, so you can apply the derivative. What you really want to do is recognize that it's actually in two variables. It's in V and let's say in A.
Okay.
Okay. And what this will do. I'll write it. What we're really doing is we're saying it's V plus V cross A.
Okay.
Plus A cross A.
Right.
And then one of the A's, in fact, the least one that satisfies this equation.
Yes.
Is the set of lambda terms.
Okay.
But you could plug lots of A's in here.
Okay.
Okay. So
right.
So now to find a context.
Yes, because finding a context is calculating a derivative.
Yes.
And you're going to end up with a 2 times A over here, and the A's going to go away from there, and this guy's going to go away.
That's right.
Just like calculus.
That's exactly right. So what you'll end up with is you'll differentiate what is essentially a constant.
Yeah.
If you're differentiating with respect to A.
Yeah.
Okay. When you go and differentiate a polynomial, well, you know, you just distribute it across the polynomial.
Right.
Right. And then when you differentiate your constant, well, that just goes away.
Yeah.
Right. And then this one gets knocked out. So we just have the V's.
Right.
Right. And then this one is essentially 2 times A, which is the same as A plus A.
Yes.
Okay. That's an A or A. That's right. That's right. So this is equivalent to V plus A plus A.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So these are two different tags.
Now let me see if I can read this correctly so far. The derivative of my set of lambda terms described by this equation.
Yeah.
In other words, the context for some structure that contains all lambda terms,
yes,
is of this form.
That's right. Now I've done a small sleight of hand to make it simpler to understand. I didn't differentiate the least fixed point.
Yeah.
I just differentiated
the right-hand
the
side.
Simpler one.
Yeah.
Right? It turns out when you differentiate the least fixed point, there's a little bit more magic.
Yeah.
And let's see if we can motivate some of that magic. What if we were to just do what people have done entirely intuitively and by hand in the world of computing semantics. So in the world of computing semantics, there's this thing called Morris equivalence.
Okay.
Right? So Morris equivalence and
like Morris Mini.
Yeah. Okay. Like Morris dancing.
Yeah. Not like Morris code.
No.
Sorry.
So Morris equivalence is a very intuitive equivalence. It says two programs are the same if they operate the same in all contexts.
Okay, very. Oh, in particular these contexts.
These contexts.
Okay,
but they didn't know about this derivative stuff,
yeah.
Right? It took until the year 2000 for Connor McBride to write this. In fact, the interesting thing about his paper, I don't know if you know this, but his paper is one of the most cited papers, and it was that paper that was rejected from Popple. So you know that thing. You know you're onto something when everyone says your idea is crazy.
Yeah, exactly.
they did this intuitively. They said, well, what's a context? Essentially, what we do is we take all the non-terminals of this grammar and we replace them by a whole. So let's just build. You know, we want to build. You know, lambda terms with holes in them. Well, let's introduce a hole. Okay. So here's our notion of context.
Yes.
Well, we have a hole. Okay?
Okay.
Right? That's our whole.
Yep.
Okay? And then, well, I can lambda abstract and put a context there.
Right.
So one of them would be just lambda abstract whole.
right? And now, notice, interestingly, I have a place I could put the hole on the left and a place I could put the hole on the right.
Yeah.
And that's the linear bit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, that's where these two things come from.
You get
from.
To just put one hole in there.
That's right. So I can put my hole like that, or I can put my hole like that.
Okay.
Okay? And notice that this grammar depends critically because we mentioned M on that
right,
grammar.
Right, right, right.
Okay? So this grammar is in some sense calculated from that grammar. Okay, and this grammar is more intuitively what you arrive at if you differentiate the least fixed point.
I see.
Okay?
I see.
So there's actually a term in here, which is the whole, which is not represented when we did this one.
Right.
That there would be a one there, essentially.
Okay.
Okay, so there's the one, the lambda abstraction,
right.
Which is essentially this guy. This guy would actually have extra structure, more context.
Right.
Now, why do we stop here? Well, we didn't do the least fixed point. Least fixed point would require us to keep going.
Yeah.
Right? That's right. What this extra stuff is.
Now, this reminds me of something else from the continuous math world, which is we don't do fixed points very often, but when we do, we get chaos.
Ah,
right. You have a Feigenbaum's number and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Maybe there's some little connection there that we can explore.
I definitely think so. Before we go there, one last little thing. So notice that we differentiated with respect to A.
Right.
But there are two variables.
Yes.
There's a V and an A.
Yeah.
And we never said what the V's are.
No.
So. Could we imagine supplying the contexts as the V's?
Oh my gosh! And this would get us out of this conundrum that the V's are coming out of thin air.
Yeah, yeah. They don't come. They come from our grammar.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, this is really cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So we can get rid of this. We can get rid of this horrible.
Where can I put this?
Oh, you want to come over and use this?
Yeah,
board?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So, I'll write it right under here. So the thought is that if M is parametric in both V and A, okay, then we know that we really want for A, we want the fixed point of M, ignoring the V's.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, by the way, we don't just want context for our A's. What we really want is UA's locations.
All right.
Okay?
I'll take that on faith there.
The reason we want that is because these things are nominal.
Right.
And we want positional.
Yes.
And UA says what a position is.
It's the point in the tree where you're finding the context.
Yeah, it's the context together. So the context, which is we calculate by the derivative of the type,
yes,
together with the rest of the term that you plug in.
Right.
So there's the T.
Okay, good.
That's your notion of position.
Yes.
Okay?
All right,
so good. So M, we want to plug in for A the fixed point of M with
right.
respect to A.
Yes.
And we want to plug in for V that thing.
Oh my gosh.
Okay, so in other words, what we really calculate as our new kind of lambda calculus is the derivative of M, remember this is with respect to A.
Yes.
Cross, and it's actually the derivative of the mu of M, but I'm just gonna wave my hands about that.
Okay.
Cross the fixed point.
Yeah.
The fixed point of M, again with respect to A.
Now that's a location.
That's a location. That's a location and a variable
right.
together with the fixed point. That's our new lambda calculus.
Right, and this guy is what we were just calling A. That's the solution to this fixed point equation.
That's right. That's right. So this is a new...
This is the set of all lambda terms.
That's right. Is it possible to make some code available? Because I have a little Haskell... data type that
sure, I think we can definitely do that.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool. I can give a URL where that...
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, perfect. Perfect. So you can show this is not hand wavy.
Yeah, actually, no, we can go
you
do
can
some
go
calculations.
Run these things.
Yeah.
Now, the interesting thing about these kinds of guys is that these locations can still refer to lambda terms that are not... Like, suppose I had a term.
Yeah.
Then the location could refer to lambda terms that are not anywhere in this term.
Right.
So we still have to filter it down if we want this
Now I'm a little bit lost. Why do we have to filter it down? Why can't I? What's non-kosher about referring to lambda terms that might not be defined in this particular exposition?
Oh, you could do that. It's just no longer physical.
Well, that's interesting because in a sense, my coordinate system up here contains, let's say I'm going to coordinatize the globe.
Mm-hmm.
I have coordinates for all kinds of points, including points that aren't in my little finite catalog of cities.
Fair enough.
So I have addresses for locations that can occur anywhere, even if I'm not going to fly over them or whatever.
But we also know that it's possible to build a model of one of these guys using only points in here.
Okay, good. So that's a little bit like a finite subset, and that's a special subset of this guy.
That's right.
I can't do calculus with that subset.
Well, actually, you know, if I build a model of a manifold in terms of vectors...
Yes.
Right? Then I can do calculus on
that. Maybe I'm falling off the rails here, but I'm envisioning that I have a finite set of these guys.
Oh, okay. I was thinking of this as the manifold.
Well, we could think of that of it that way, too, instead of what I'm thinking.
If
that makes things clearer.
Yeah. Okay, I think that's the...
Okay.
As long as it's finite.
I think of this as the set of locations.
Yeah.
The set of guys of this form.
Yeah.
In our analogy.
Yes.
And then... putting them in the monad somewhere, I'm not sure exactly where that is yet, is somehow finding addresses for locations of them. This is a location.
Yes.
Okay, so maybe now we're getting a little more clarity here. This is a set of locations.
Yeah.
This is a set of addresses for locations.
Yes. That's right.
And our notion of position is not clarified yet.
Well, again, what I was thinking was that... this is not just locations, but it's the whole... Remember when we drew our tree?
Yeah.
This is really the whole tree. And we know that...
Right.
Right? And we know that any... Well, I can describe locations in the tree.
Right. This is a set of particular locations, but every node in here, it lives in that set.
Right.
Okay, good.
Yes. So then let's add... can we add to our picture another widget?
Yeah.
Which is the tree itself.
Yeah.
So if this is the locations, then I actually want, you know, I want some widget like the manifold.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
So this thing covers that thing, right? So there are places inside here.
This is almost like a topology on top of that,
coordinatizing.
Coordinatizing the topology, the open sets in the topology, as opposed to the manifold itself.
Right.
Maybe we've inserted a layer like that.
Yeah. Intuitively, if that feels correct.
Yeah, I'm really waiting. You know, what I'm really trying to do here is find interesting questions.
Yeah. And we
leave those standing that are real and knock those over. That's the purpose of this series, is to knock those over that are
crummy. Do you get responses from the viewers?
Oh, all the time, We should look, often they solve problems for us.
Sweet.
We throw problems, we say, we don't know what this is. What do you guys think?
Well, we
have a big audience and they're very, very bright.
Oh, fantastic. That's wonderful. And the questions are always the fruit of all of this, right?
That's right. That's what keeps us going. That's the fuel.
So there is this open question then. What's the relationship between the locations and the widget itself? And I argue, in fact, if we follow Huey's proposal, then that is a monad.
I see.
This calculation is clearly monadic.
Yes.
Okay. And you could think of that as a kind of monad.
Okay. So there we go. We've actually figured out that the relationship between points in my physical set and coordinates for them is very much like values into monads, and we've done it through this incredibly interesting. Development in the lambda calculus that turns it into something that's looking a lot more like continuous mathematics.
It feels that way.
It does feel that way. And there's so many analogies here that there, you know, there's got to be a pony in the room. but remember one of the things that Stephen Hawking is best known for is finding a relationship between the equations of black hole physics and the equations of thermodynamics.
Yeah.
Things that don't have any obvious connection whatsoever, but guess what? There's a formal correspondence, and we can make Well, he made great truck out of it, and maybe we can too.
Yeah.
Let's wrap up for today.
Sounds good.
Once again, Channel 9, I hope you enjoyed meeting Greg Meredith, and I hope to have him back for many more of these things as long as Channel 9's film doesn't run dry.
Well, Brian, thank you so much, and as always, I really enjoy jamming with you at the board.
It's really great. It was a lot of fun. Thanks, Greg.